Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Kelvin Ng from Yale University, and this is my co-host, Ahmed from Princeton University. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Ronit Ritchie, the author of Banishment and Belonging, Exile and Diaspora in Serendip, Lanka and Ceylon, published by Cambridge University Press in 2019. Ronit Ritchie is the Sternberg Tamir Chair in Comparative Cultures and Associate Professor in the Departments of Asian Studies and Comparative Religion at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She is also Associate Professor at the School of Culture, History and Language at the Australian National University in Canberra. Over the past several years, she has been working to establish a new field of Indonesian studies in Israel. She teaches the Indonesian language and various courses on Indonesia, Islam in Southeast Asia, travel literature, and translation studies. Her research focuses on Islamic manuscript traditions of the Indonesian Malay world, Javanese literature, exile and diaspora in colonial Asia, and histories and practices of translation. She is the author of the multiple prize-winning Islam Translated, Literature, Conversion, and the Arabic Cosmopolis of South and Southeast Asia. Ronit asks in this present book, Lanka, Ceylon, Serendip, merely three disparate names for a single island? Perhaps, yet the three diverge in the historical echoes, literary cultures, maps and memories they evoke. Names that have intersected and overlapped, in a treatise, a poem, a document, only to go their own ways. But despite different trajectories, all three are tied to narratives of banishment and exile. Welcome, Ronit, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thank you so much for taking your time to talk about your book.
Can you start us off
by saying a few words about yourself? Can you share with us how did your relationship with Lanka develop over time?
I was born in the United States, but I grew up in Israel for the most part, and I completed a BA and an MA in Indian Languages and Literatures at the Hebrew University. And when I finished towards the end of my MA studies, my mentor, Professor David Shulman, suggested to me that I might think about the possibility of doing a PhD on Indonesia. I had never been to Indonesia before. I knew very, very little about it. But it was really the sort of the historical and cultural and linguistic connections between India and Indonesia that inspired that idea. And I thought it would be a very interesting adventure. And therefore, I decided to study for a PhD. And I went to the University of Michigan, where I studied with Professor Nancy Florida. And I did a PhD in comparative literature. That's sort of a little bit of my background. After that, after completing the PhD and living in Indonesia and India for a while, doing the research and going back to the United States, I studied and worked in Singapore and Australia. And several years ago, I returned to Israel after living in the diaspora for a long time. And I've been, like you said, I've been working here to create or to establish the field of Indonesian studies here in Israel. Now, my relationship with Lanka, in some ways, is a repetition of what happened to me with my relationship with Indonesia, because Sri Lanka was a country that I didn't really know much about, and I didn't have a connection to it prior to doing the research for this book. What happened was that while I was doing my PhD research, I read many books for my prelims, for my exams, and for the writing process. And one of the books was Taika Shuaib Alim's Arabic, Persian, and Arwi in Sardip and Tamil Nadu, which is a book about mostly about the Muslims' contribution in Tamil Nadu and Sri Lanka to literature in Arabic and a little bit in Persian and also in Arabu Tamil or Arwi. I was reading this book, and it's a very long book, and somewhere along the way I came across a footnote that mentioned exiles from Java to Sarandib or to Ceylon, to Sri Lanka in the colonial period. Whenever I'm asked about the idea, the germ of the idea of this book, that's the moment I go back to, because I remember being very struck by this footnote and being very curious. And I think part of the reason was that I had been studying about Indonesia for several years by then and taking history courses and courses about Indonesian culture and literature. And I had never, ever heard about this episode of royalty, members of royal families from across the archipelago being exiled to colonial Ceylon. And the footnote also mentioned Professor Hussein Mia, who was the source of this footnote. And so I looked up his writings. I found that he had written two books about this community that of exiles or descendants of exiles. And I decided that once I finished the PhD and I have time for another research project, I will try to go back to this topic. And several years later, with the encouragement of Professor Hussein Mia, who gave me some advice and gave me some names of contacts in Sri Lanka, I took my first trip to Colombo, and that was in 2009. So really, between the first time I set foot in Sri Lanka and the publication of the book, a decade passed, and I spent much of my time during those 10 years working on this research and creating really this relationship with Sri Lanka and with the Malay community there.
Thank you so much for that. And now we have this fantastic book. That kind of gets into some of what I want to ask in the next question, which is what the research process was like and how was your writing experience? Specifically, how does this book connect to or depart from your previous work? And did your questions and concerns about the cosmopolitan and the vernacular in Islam Translated inform this book?
Look, I think what we do in the present is always in some ways also, well, maybe not always, but often linked also to prior projects. And like I said, this new project, this project in Sri Lanka emerged from a footnote of a book that I was reading for the Islam Translated project. There are links in terms of thinking, remaining in the same part of the world, thinking about connections between South Asia and Southeast Asia, thinking about the Indian Ocean world, thinking about literature and questions of translation. But in many ways, it also felt like a very different project and a very new field, really, in terms of, at least in terms of entering Sri Lankan studies. Because like I said earlier, for me, it was a new place, a new world, a new society. And I really had, in many ways, to start from scratch. And the way the research progressed was really in two paths that were sort of parallel. One was that I was working to create the database for this research, and I had a grant from the British Library's Endangered Archives Program, which is a program that funds surveying and preservation, digital preservation of endangered or fragile materials all over the world. And so they agreed to fund a process of initially a pilot project of surveying surviving Malay writing, surviving Malay materials in Sri Lanka. And after that was completed, a small sort of exploratory project, also a larger project of preservation of Malay manuscripts, books, letters, and other documents. And all of this is now available, freely accessible on the British Library website for anyone who is interested. So I was doing that. I was going to Sri Lanka again and again, usually twice a year over several years, and trying to meet as many individuals and families from the Malay community across the island in order to talk to them and see if they had any such materials, and if they did, if they were willing to have them digitalized. And that those explorations took me all over Sri Lanka, from Jaffna in the north to Hambantota in the south, Colombo to Trincomalee, to towns and to cities and to very small out-of-the-way places. And that was for me, like I said, a way to collect the data for the research, but it was also a wonderful personal experience because I was welcomed warmly everywhere I went, and I never encountered anyone who had Malay writing or Malay materials who refused to show them or to share them or to allow me access to them. And gradually I learned a lot also from these travels, because I met many people and I listened to their stories about their families, parents, grandparents, things that were passed down through the generations that were not necessarily, not necessarily accessible in the written documents. So that was one part of the research. And the other part of the research was the more conventional part of actually reading these materials, or some of them, not all of them, and also visiting the National Archives of Sri Lanka in Colombo, where there is a small collection of microfilms, which were prepared by the aforementioned Professor Hussein Mia, who collected manuscripts in the 1970s. And those manuscripts were microfilmed at the time. Their quality is now quite poor, and some of them are no longer readable. And the original materials, the original manuscripts, are no longer at the archives, and no one is quite sure where they are. But anyway, I worked with these microfilms as well, as much as I could, and I also conducted research in British and Dutch archives for the book. And of course, and this is a major, major part of the research, I searched for and read Javanese sources, Indonesian, but mostly Javanese sources that had to do with the themes of the book, themes of exile and banishment.
Thank you for sharing these insights about your research process. And the story sounds very familiar for other people working on different parts of the Indian Ocean, to be honest. The book is quite rich, and it has 9 chapters with an introduction and a very useful glossary. The book is also very beautifully produced and richly illustrated. I really enjoyed reading it, and I would like to dive into the chapters. So in the first, the introduction, we start with Sorandi Blanca Ceylon, about which you ask, do the different, perhaps distinct, overlapping or competing names of a place shape the ways in which that place is imagined and the way its histories are told and retold across space, time, and literary cultures. So can you guide us to your approach to the island's history and its Malay population from the vantage point of the temporally embodied names of the island? How do you use this device or framework to narrate the long-dure history of the island and its Malay population?
Yes. One of the things that really struck me about this story, this, if we can call it that, this the story of the Sri Lankan Malays, and like I say right at the beginning of the book, I think maybe on the first page or second page, this designation itself is problematic. You have to use some designation when you speak about a group of people and when you speak about a place. But very early on, it struck me that these designations are both Sri Lanka and the Malays of Sri Lanka, which is what they are called today, are problematic, and they mask a lot of details and diversity and complexity behind them. They sort of present us with a veil that we need to sort of move aside in order to understand this history. So first of all, in terms of the term Malay, we know that the ancestors of this community that's today called the Malays of Sri Lanka comes from very diverse backgrounds all across the Indonesian archipelago, and there is evidence of that in many of the sources where we find names of particular places and people that come from the different islands of what's now Indonesia, what used to be the Dutch East Indies. So the designation Malay itself is like an umbrella term, really, for something much more complicated. And then when we say Sri Lanka, of course, we're thinking about the modern nation state. So what did we have there earlier, and what is the relationship of these different names to questions of exile and diaspora? So for me, one of the sort of things that I found early on, again, in the earlier project, even before when I was still working on Islam Translated, was that I read all kinds of texts, the Islamic texts, and some of them had to do with Islamic history or histories of the prophets of Islam. And this story about Nabi Adam, who, according to Muslim tradition, is both the first man but also the first prophet, the story of him falling from paradise or being banished from paradise and landing or falling in Sarandib, which is the Arab name for Sri Lanka, that always struck me as curious. Why of all places around the world, why would he be banished to Sarandib? And so I read a little bit about that even earlier on, and I realized that this is a very old tradition. I tended to think that maybe it's sort of the Javanese imagination that added it as, you know, as a detail to these stories, which is something that often happens. We have many examples where sort of traditional stories are expanded or changed over time or as they travel to new places. But in this particular case, I realized that the story of Adam, Nabi Adam, falling in Sarandib was a very old tradition and a very sort of well-known tradition. And so then when I started working on this project, I was curious as to what might it have meant for people who were exiled, as the Malays were, their forefathers were exiled during the colonial time from what's now Indonesia, from the Indonesian archipelago, Indonesian Malay archipelago, to colonial Ceylon. What could it have meant for them to know that they were being banished to the place of banishment of the first human and first prophet of Islam? Did they know this? Did they realize this? And if they did, what might it have meant to them? So that's the sort of a little bit about the element of Sarandib and its relationship to banishment, because the banishment of Nabi Adam from paradise is in some ways the prototype or the paradigm for all human exile later on. I mean, the banishment from heaven, from the divine realm to life on earth, to human life, to human toil, to human sadness and suffering, and is a paradigm for many other exiles that we humans have endured and continue to endure. And something sort of similar happened to me also with the name Lanka, because I'm a Ramayana lover, and I've been a Ramayana lover for a long time. And I can't hear the name Lanka or Sri Lanka, or at least I couldn't. Now I have many more associations with the name of the place, but I couldn't hear it without immediately thinking about the Ramayana and thinking about Lanka as a place of banishment, as a place of exile for Sita in the Ramayana story. And that also seemed to me curious. Like, how is it that this single place, this very small island in the Indian Ocean, is connected both with this paradigmatic exile in the Muslim tradition and with this foundational story in Hinduism or in, you know, Indian or South Asian traditions. And so it struck me that, and this is in some ways at the core of my book, it struck me that each of these three names, Sarandeep and Lanka, and of course Ceylon or Ceylong or Ceylan, as you know, it was pronounced differently in different languages, both European languages and South and Southeast Asian languages, but this Ceylon as a place of very important place of colonial banishment. So all three names are linked in one way or another to exile and banishment. And that seemed like a very interesting theme to explore. And especially, how would people who were exiled from the Indonesian archipelago, among them some very important figures from royal families from across the archipelago, from different kingdoms, different sultanates, and their retinues and their families and servants, what would it be like for them to be banished to a place that already has a history of banishment, a very significant history of banishment, which is linked to important religious traditions and literary traditions. And so these echoes of exile are already there in that place. And it's important to mention here, because it's not to be, I think, taken for granted, because we know that the Ramayana, the Ramayana tradition, is very, very important in Indonesia. That is, we know from other places in the Muslim world that it's not important, or it might even be shunned. And we can see in India that there are the popularity of the Ramayana is there may be some Muslim communities where it was important, or it may even be important now, but it doesn't approach the importance of this story to Indonesian Muslims. This is important to mention, because people might assume or might think that the Ramayana is not really relevant to this story, because the Malays were, for the most part, a Muslim community. Not all of them, not every single one of them, but the majority of people who were banished were Muslim, and with time, Islam really became one of the sort of core elements that kept this community together. And the Ramayana might seem sort of far away from a Muslim community, but that is not the case when we think of Indonesia, where the Ramayana, and Java in particular, where the Ramayana has been a very, very important source of art, different forms of art, especially the shadow puppet theater, the wayang, of sculpture, of literary production, of poetry, and also of political thought in some ways, and especially in thinking about how kings, the relationship between kings and subjects, for example, the relationship within families. For me, I even though I had to search for the evidence and I had to, I needed to show that this was the case, but my assumption was that it was likely that especially people from the courts of Java, from royal families in the 18th century would be late 17th and early 18th century, mid 18th century. My assumption was that there was at least a good chance that they would have been familiar with the Ramayana tradition, and that the name Lanka, Alenka in Javanese would have had a familiar ring for them. One final thing about this is that in thinking about these terminologies or this nomenclature, these different names, another sort of aspect of this was also thinking about the relationship between exile or banishment and return. These stories, these traditions that I mentioned, they also contain in them this, I think, this notion that exile and return can be situated on continuums. They're not necessarily, on the opposite ends. They can be closer than we think or than we tend to imagine. And so, for example, if we think about Nabi Adam's banishment from paradise to Lanka, to Sarandib, and by the way, the mountaintop where he is said to have landed is called Adam's Peak today. We can think of the Malays arriving in colonial times as not just being banished to Ceylon, but also as returning to a place, to the place where Adam first stepped on earth, or where the first human first descended to earth. We can think about Sita's banishment to Lanka and her return as her return, which was supposed to be a time of joy and peace, as something that turned into, at least in many of the Ramayana versions, into a sort of internal exile, where she returns with Rama and she returns to Ayodhya, she returns to her previous life in the palace, but in fact it is an exile of sorts because of the suspicions against her and because of the suffering she endures until she decides to finally return to and be swallowed by the earth. And then if we think about the Malay community, the forefathers of the Malay community, we have quite a few examples of people who were banished to Ceylon and spent the rest of their lives there, never returned to Indonesia. But we also have examples of people who were allowed to return. And then I tried to also follow in the footsteps of some of those figures as much as that was possible to see what it was like to return. And we also have some examples of members of royal families who were banished, returned to Java, and then were banished again. So throughout their lives, they experienced both exile and return, sometimes multiple times. And finally, we have the returns that are not returns in life, but returns in death. That is, there are people who are including some very important figures who passed away in exile in Ceylon, but then were sent back for burial in Java. And there are some very interesting stories also surrounding those returns. So it seemed that in all three cases, I mean, using all three names and the sort of imaginings that accompanied those names and those histories, we can also think about the relationship between banishment and return.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. I find the book really useful in thinking about how to write island history in the Indian Ocean. And as you just mentioned, in talking about exiles and return, another strategy in writing this book was writing a connected history that is not merely focused on the island itself as islanded, as we may say, but also views from the other shore, that of the Indonesian archipelago, and in particular Java. In your opinion, what can that tell us about the frontiers of the Malay world? And what does that signify for the Indian Ocean writ large? And how would you situate this book within that of diaspora studies within the Indian Ocean?
Yes, well, where to begin even?
Maybe I'm thinking about a connected history of this island not secluded from,
Yes, I mean, for me, it was very important to make these connections, some of which I've already mentioned, through the stories and through the images and through the different religious traditions. Like you say, there's also the geographical, the sort of concrete connections within the Indian Ocean. I think that if we look only at one perspective, for example, looking at the history of the Malays on the island, I mean, that in itself is a fascinating topic, but I feel like if we're thinking about mobility, which is a very sort of important trope in many of the studies, in Indian Ocean studies, if we're thinking about mobility, then it's very interesting to think about the movement of people, but also about what happens on the different shores. I mean, some of the people were moving around and going back and forth, and some of the people remained. For example, in this study, I think about the people in Java who had relatives or friends or subjects or kings who left, and even if they remained on the Javanese shore, I think that the fact that some people that they knew were exiled or sent away, that had an impact also on those who stayed. I tried to think and tried to find sources that would explain also what was the effect of this banishment on those who were less mobile in body, but maybe in spirit or in their thoughts or in their imagination. They were also moving across the sea. In terms of the frontiers, and vice versa, because the people who arrived in Ceylon continued, of course, to think about their places of origin, and they often continued to long for them or to write letters, some of which we're lucky enough to have, and to hope to go back and to imagine and reimagine those places that they came from. So what I'm trying to say is that I think the mobility and the connection is real in the sense that people got on ships and they got off ships and they traveled. And that is a very important element in this story. But then there is also the there are the imaginings and the thoughts and the longings and the dreams. In the book, I talk about dreams that also, the line between dream and reality is very unclear, is often very, very unclear, very vague. In terms of the frontiers of the Malay world, it's interesting to see that this story of the Sri Lankan Malays didn't play an important role in Malay studies in general. When we look at the sort of mainstream studies of Malay literature and Malay history, there is often, the Sri Lankan Malays are often noted. They're not completely ignored, but there's just usually just a few lines about them or something sort of very general that they, that they exist, that they're a small community, that they continued writing in the Malay language, but they're not really or significantly included in studies of the Malay world, nor in studies of Malay literature. They're also missing, for the most part, from Indonesian histories. This is something that surprised me at first, because I thought I would try and find the Indonesian historians who have written about this topic, and I thought that there would be, quite a few of them, or that I would find Indonesian history books where there is quite a bit of information about the banishment of people from across the archipelago to Ceylon and also to other places. But I found that this was not a topic that much has been written about at all. And then finally, if you look at histories of Sri Lanka, you do not find the Malays, or you barely find them in the sort of, again, I'm talking about sort of the typical mainstream histories. So in a way, this community was marginalized in different fields and different kinds of studies. And I think that what this current study, one of the things that it shows is that we can significantly expand the boundaries of the Malay world if we look beyond the sort of the conventional sites where we typically study. And this includes not just Sri Lanka, but also the Cape, and in recent, the Cape in South Africa, where more or less around the same time, people were exiled. It was also a Dutch settlement, and people from the archipelago were also sent as slaves and as exiles to the Cape. And there are more and more studies in recent years looking also at what's the community that's called Cape Malays. And this is also part of, again, the studies in the Indian Ocean on incarceration, forced migration, like Claire Anderson's work or Carrie Ward's work. In a way, a study like this expands the boundaries of the Malay world, but then it also connects with other studies and other stories across the Indian Ocean, from Africa to Indonesia and beyond. There was one other thing I wanted to say. In terms of the connected history, maybe that one of the things I wanted to do in the book is also connect the or introduce or highlight the voices of people that are often not heard in the studies, in studies of the Indian Ocean, of the Malay world also, and of the literature of the Malay world, the Malay-Indonesian world. Of course, when we think about exiles, we're looking here at, there's this tension between the fact that many of these figures who were sent away were very, very important figures in their societies of origin, from Java and other places. We have kings, we have princes, we have heirs to the throne, we have queens, and many sort of relatives of these within from within these families. But then when they arrive on the other shore, they're of course stripped of their titles, of their lifestyle, and of power, and so they in some ways become almost like subaltern voices, maybe subaltern kings, if something like that is even possible. We have very, very few studies that sort of uncover their voices and their thoughts or their perceptions of banishment. And so this is another element of that was important to me and that I tried to bring out again in looking at trying to recreate these voices or these perspectives from the different shores across the ocean.
And I think you succeed in doing that quite well. So in thinking about banishment and exile, whether it's by Allah or by the Bhagwans or by the Dutch or the British, we access unusual sources that usually historians think of as useless for writing history. And I find your book quite imaginative in strategically thinking through these sources and using them to write history. So can you introduce us to the Malay genres of the Hikayat and the Sher, to think about the relationship between genres, history, and literature?
Yes, well, I'm not officially a historian. My background is in comparative literature, and I, of course, you know, the work is very much embedded in history and in historical documents. But first and foremost, I am interested in and I look at these literary texts. Again, when we, you know, even our own definitions of what is literature and what is history, our definitions today don't necessarily map on very easily or comfortably to earlier times. So if you ask me about these genres in Malay, the hikayat, so hikayat is we nowadays we when we have to define it, we usually say that this is writing in prose, because we're contrasting it. We're often contrasting it with more poetic genres. But hikayat is really a very, very broad term. It's basically a story or a narrative, but it covers many, many different things. I mean, we have hikayats which are telling us a history of a particular kingdom or a particular region. Hikayat can be a romance. It can be a story of adventures, and it often is. It can be a travel narrative. It can be more of a political text. So it's hard to pinpoint anything specific about the hikayat because it can really cover almost any topic at all. Whereas the sha'ir is poetry and written in meter and often rhyming meter, and sha'ir is one of the some of the oldest texts that we have in the Malay language are sha'ir. And both of these, you can tell from the names that they probably derive from Arabic, but they've taken on their own character in the Malay world. I can maybe give an example of the use of genres in some of these manuscripts that I was exploring that I found in the homes of Malay families in Sri Lanka. So one of the stories that I wrote about is called Hikayat Tuan Gusti, which is a retelling in Malay in Sri Lanka of the story of the Islamization of Java. I found it very interesting because it's a foundational story in Java of the coming of Islam and the especially the participation in this process of a group of nine walis. They're known as the Wali Songo, and Songo is nine in Javanese. Nine men who are believed, according to Javanese tradition, to have brought Islam from afar to Java, and they're the ones who are credited with convincing the local population that Islam is the true religion and that it should be adopted by the Javanese. And there are many stories and tales about them, and you know, they differ depending on period and depending on a region within Java. This hikayat that was found in Sri Lanka is tells the story of Sunan Giri, who is one of these nine. And we could say that it's a combination, I think, of history, again, because it's recounting the Islamization of Java as seen from the shores of Ceylon. It's a form of travel literature, I think, because it sort of guides the reader across the island of Java to different places and introduces different figures and different kings. And it allows this tradition, this very, very important core Javanese tradition of the Walis, of the Wali Songo, to remain alive in exile. So that's an example of one of the hikayats, which I think was very significant. And from what Hussein Mia wrote in one of his books, I think in Lost Cousins, which is a book that looks at the history and also some of the literature of the Sri Lankan Malays, he talks about speaking with the older generation. When he did his research, you know, this was about 50 years ago, so a lot of the people have, of course, passed away by now, and I could longer speak with them, but that the older generation told him that this hikayat was very, very popular among the Malays in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So that's one example that also connects with questions of memory and place. And another example that I can give is a poem. It's actually not a shayr. Shayr is more of a Malay poetic genre. And the example I want to give is a kidung. A kidung is a genre of songs in Javanese. In one of the chapters, I discuss a compendium of different texts that I came across. And within this compendium, which contains all kinds of brief texts and snippets and genealogies, I came across this poem, which the title of which is Kidunguru Mekso Ingwongi. And this is a Javanese song, and the title means a song guarding in the night. And for me, this was a very important moment because it was the first time that I came across Javanese writing within a Malay manuscript. And like I mentioned earlier, even though we know for a fact and we have a lot of evidence, especially in the Dutch archive from the colonial period, that the people who came from who were sent from the Indonesian archipelago were very diverse and came from many ethnic and linguistic backgrounds. Even though we know this, we have very little evidence, at least so far, for linguistic diversity in the community in colonial Ceylon. And certainly today, when and for a long time by now, Malay became the sort of unifying language of this community. And so reading this compendium and coming across this poem in Javanese was a very important moment for me. And so this poem shows us, first of all, it shows us the continuity also of this genre of kidung that was brought along into exile. And it's written in Tembang Mochopat, which is a Javanese poetic meter. So we see that the poetic meters continue to be used. Again, we don't know if we don't have evidence that these kinds of poems were also written written anew in colonial Ceylon, but we at least have evidence that this kind of a kidung was preserved in exile, including the meter, and this connects to what I just recounted about the Hikayatu Angusti. This is a poem that is attributed to one of the walis. So the Hikayat tells the story of Sunan Giri, one of the walis, and the poem is attributed to Sunan Kalijogo, who is usually considered the leader of these nine walis. And it's a very well-known poem. It's even well-known today, and it's considered a very powerful, very potent poem because it was written by Sunan Kalijogo and because it's asking for protection. The title is A Song Guarding in the Night, and it's a poem that a song that asks for protection from all of the things that can appear in the night, in the darkness, and threaten humans. So if it's jinns or spirits or different kinds of spirits of invisible beings, if it's fire, if it's water, all kinds of adversity. And so I think that for me, there was a connection between this Hikayat and the story of Sunan Giri and the Islamization of Java and the preservation of this poem, very important poem, potent poem by another one of the Walis in exile. And we could even think of it as a request for protection, the singing or the reciting of this poem as a request for protection in the darkness or in the night of exile by those who read it, who rewrote and rewrote it and recopied it in these manuscripts. How is that related to history, to the question that you asked me? I think that, you know, this is not maybe straightforward history, but these are just, you know, two examples of many other texts but that are mentioned in the book. But I think that these two together tell us something about cultural, they certainly tell us something about cultural memory and about the kinds of texts and the kinds of messages or stories or ideas, imaginings that were deemed important enough to be preserved in the new land and in very different circumstances.
Thank you so much for that wonderful elaborate answer. And what I'm really struck by as well is also the idea that these texts may contain an idea of sejarah or of tariq that may differ from our conceptions today of disciplinary history, but it really bespeaks what the people writing them at the time thought to be important or significant for them in terms of cultural memory. And I was also really struck by the heteroglossia evident in these Malay manuscripts from Ceylon and their use of Malay, Javanese, Arabic, and Arbu Tamil. Malay itself being an incredibly heteroglossic language itself. So I'm just really curious about the analytical possibilities you find in analyzing diasporic culture and the preservation of language, the transmission of literary texts, and the maintenance of genres and of a script. What informed the decision to translate or preserve certain terms, and what informed the decision to use, you know, Jawi or Rumi as a script?
Yes, I mean, I would also love to know more about why certain texts were copied or selected for copying or for preservation, and that's the kind of question that, you know, we can make assumptions. We can say, okay, this was copied, this was preserved, therefore it was important. But we have to constantly remember that we're working within a very partial and fragmented archive. And this is something that I was very conscious of, because, especially because of my methodology, which I elaborated on before, of sort of searching for these texts and knowing that every text that I find is, if I may use the word serendipity here, there was a lot of, you know, serendipity involved. And I say that because serendipity is a word that derives from the word sarandib. So there was, you know, luck. There was sometimes I might have missed something very important just because I was unable to meet the right people. So I hesitate. I'm saying all this because I hesitate to say something very conclusive about why certain texts were translated or preserved while others were not. But we can work with what we have, and I think that. I think that what we find in these manuscripts and the compendium that I mentioned is a good example because it sort of contains so much in between its two covers. But you can see similar things if you look across other manuscripts as well. I feel like these kinds of manuscripts are like a microcosm that tells us a lot about this history, about this community, and including about choices made about what is important to preserve and to transmit in terms of Islamic texts and intellectual genealogies. And one of the things that we see in these kinds of manuscripts is, like you said, the combination of languages. We see that all of these languages that you mentioned yourself, of course, Arabic, but also Tamil and Malay and Javanese in the few instances where Javanese was found, they're all written in the Arabic script. So there are four different languages and maybe more written in a single script, which tells us something about connectivity. I mean, we were talking earlier about these connections across the Indian Ocean and across shores and the script is definitely one form of, as I see it, of a connection. We see in these manuscripts that we often find information about the owner of the manuscript or the author or the scribe, and that is one way to find out more about the diversity of this community, the diversity of this history. So, for example, in this compendium, to which I'm speaking about the compendium because there's a chapter dedicated to it, and so that's a sort of a very elaborate example. We find information about the owner who hails from Makassar, which is on one island, the island that's now known as Sulawesi in Indonesia. But he also mentions that he's a descendant of a Javanese haji. So we have here something also about the familial networks and the networks of pilgrimage and the different languages, which also represent different communities, especially in Ceylon itself, where the manuscript is written and is put together, is assembled. We learn something about the context between Tamil-speaking Muslims, Malay-speaking Muslims, Javanese-speaking Muslims, or speaking or writing. And, of course, all of them are always intimately connected also with the Arabic language and texts that derive or are translated or transmitted from Arabic. And we also find here evidence of the way that Ceylon is situated and was situated squarely at a crossroads between, and again, this goes back to the question about the Indian Ocean world, situated squarely at a crossroads between the Indonesian archipelago, the Indonesian Malay archipelago, and that world, which is part of such an important part of the Muslim world, and on the other side, in the other direction, the Middle East and the Arab world. And we know this also from the history of pilgrim ships coming from Southeast Asia, docking in Ceylon and then continuing on the Hajj to the Middle East. But these kinds of manuscripts often tell this story in very concrete ways, again, through the multiple languages, through the use of the script, and through the text or bits of text and citations that they contain within them.
And that reminds me about this term that you employ in chapter 4, Ceylon, where you ask how life in exile was imagined and understood in Java, how exile affected those left behind, as well as those returning home from Ceylon, and what meanings, tensions, and creative possibilities infuse narratives of exile. Can you talk a bit more about the word Ceylon itself, or Disalangake in Javanese, or Disailankan in Malay, and specifically what it suggests about ideas of exile, banishment, directionality?
Yes, I mean, this is also something that I sort of caught my attention early on when I started reading about, especially when I started reading Javanese texts about this period of banishment, that and that the word Ceylon itself, which is a noun, was turned into a verb. These forms, disailankan in Malay and diselongaken in Javanese, it's you can hear that it's basically the same structure, but pronounced a little bit differently in the two languages. It literally means to be Ceylon'd. And at first, it's a passive form, and the kan at the end is causative, meaning that this is something that you cause someone else, you do it to someone else. So this is something that was done. It's described as so and so was disailankan, so and so was exiled, so and so was Ceylon, sent to Ceylon, and initially it probably meant just being sent to Ceylon, being banished to Ceylon. But gradually, and that tells us something about the centrality of Ceylon as a site of banishment, its importance as a site of banishment. But then its use became more generalized. And over time, it came to mean to be banished or to be exiled. Now, these are not the only words in these languages. And I also did a small study about the vocabulary, the range of words used for banishment. But it's definitely one of the important terms that are used again and again. And then I came across this this text where someone was described as disailankan ke negari kap in Malay, which means he was Ceylon'd to the Cape. So that shows us that Ceylon itself, to be Ceylon, became synonymous with exile. And so that is the sort of the point about, again, if we're thinking about the names, the names of the place, the name of the place itself became synonymous with the act of exiling. I just wanted to say something about the people left behind. But if you want to ask
that's a really good point to talk about the immobile and the mobile at the same time. And in chapter 5, you do some of that work. And in connection to that, I think your book also makes an important intervention in thinking about writing emotions into history and paying attention as well to gender dynamics. So in chapter 5, Exilic Journeys in Time, Place, and Writing, I would like to think about the theme of exile, exilic life as depicted and remembered in Javanese texts. And how did you read into them the challenges and emotional turmoil experienced by long-term exiles returning to Java? And if you can elaborate on the gendered perspectives on exile and return in relation to that. So the notion of emotions and at the same time the gendered perspectives in connection to that.
Yes, that's always connected, right? I mean, emotions, and especially emotions and women, we tend to think of those as very connected. Look, to me, this was one of the most challenging but also most enjoyable parts of the research, looking for the Javanese side of the story. Because even though most of my research was done in Sri Lanka, and I found very interesting manuscripts and texts to work with, I was very sort of, because of my earlier work and my ongoing attachment to Java and to Javanese studies, I was very eager to find the traces of this story of exile in on the Javanese side. And I want to begin by saying that it was very challenging because we don't really have, like I said earlier, we don't really have many secondary sources in Indonesian or written in Indonesia about this period, about the experiences of the exiles. And if you go to the Javanese sources, where do you begin? Usually the Javanese histories, which are often written in the genre of babad, these babads are typically hundreds of pages long, and you know they don't have a table of contents, or they're not divided into chapters. Or, I mean, it's really not easy to know where to look, where to begin. So I started looking at several babads from this period that more or less describe this period of the early mid 18th century. Some of my inspiration came from the work of the late Merle Rickliffe, who was a very, very, very important, prominent historian of Java, who sadly passed away recently. And he wrote several books about the courts of central Java around this period. And so there were some hints in his scholarship as where I should look. The mention of exile in these babads is often very brief. You can often find just one or two sentences. And again, I'm talking about manuscripts of several hundred pages. You can find just one or two sentences here and there. So-and-so was banished to Ceylon. So-and-so was Ceylon. And this was also a question for me. If this experience of banishment was important, as I imagine it to have been, why do these sources pass over it in almost in silence? It's unusual to find a longer description. But again, you know, what we have is what we have. And so one of the very interesting passages about exile appears in a well-known history, which is titled Babad Giyanti. And I talk about this in the chapter that you mentioned. And what we have there is we have two women. Again, this goes also to the question about gendered perspective. We have two women who returned from exile, and they visit the court. They visit the king, the Sultan of Surakarta, and they are recounting to him some of their experiences in exile. And they talk about community. They're talking about the way that the exiles came together around two very charismatic gurus in Ceylon. And they talk about the meals, the communal meal that they would prepare every Friday after the prayers. They talk about praying together. And so this is a glimpse into exilic life that we very rarely get. So the sense of community, the sense of coming together with Muslims who are not necessarily from amongst the exiles, but it's a larger community, the charismatic teacher, the importance of the guru, the importance of food, the importance of prayer, the importance of Quranic readings. So we get a glimpse of all of that. And then towards the end of this section, they also tell him about an incident which you know is fascinating, but again it's the only one I came across in my entire search of this type. And it talks about the guru looking at one of the exiles who seemed very sort of sad and lonely, and he asked him, What do you miss? What do you remember about Java? What do you miss? What are the things that you long for? And then this man talks about the fruits. He talks about the fruits, and he talks about food that he is longing for, that he cannot find in his place of banishment. And so this this brings together the very sort of mundane, the everyday, the food, the fruits that he's longing for, with sort of the larger framework of cultural longing and all the things that were no longer available to these exiles, and at the same time the comfort that they could find in the community that they created in the relationship with a teacher. And the teacher, the guru, after he hears these words, he is able through his powers, his special powers, and to make these foods available to the exile. They arrive miraculously from Java. And from that day onwards, every Friday, they emerge. These Javanese delicacies emerge from the sleeve, from the sleeve of the gown that the guru is wearing. And they comfort the hearts of the exiles. So this is a story that is retold by these women, Javanese women returning from exile, to the king. And the king listens, and he's in awe when he hears this story. An interesting detail that I don't think is included in the book, but this description talks about tempeh. I don't know, tempeh, you know, it's a kind of a food made from fermented soybeans, kind of like tofu, but also a little bit different. And this is one of it's very typical Javanese food. And this is one of the things that the exile misses. And so the tempeh arrives every Friday in Ceylon. And then there is a section in the Javanese text that also explains that on the other shore in Java, the tempeh seller, whose tempeh disappeared every Friday, and he had no idea why or where it went, he found coins every Friday on the shelf or in the place where he put the tempeh the previous night. So I think that also very small detail, but it also tells us something about these ongoing links or connections between the exiles and those left behind. And sort of there's a mutual connection. It's not that the tempeh disappears and benefits the exiles, but the tempeh seller remains, you know, is left with nothing, but he is also compensated for his participation in this network, this small economic network of tempeh selling. So one element of the gendered perspective is to see that it is the women, even though mentions of exile are few and far between. When we do have a story like this, which is very rare, it is the women who tell it. And it is the women who speak about food and about cooking and about community and about relationships. So I found that, you know, to be worthy of note, that it is the women who voice these aspects, these more emotional and emotional and social aspects of the exilic experience. And the other mention of a gendered perspective in this chapter is the story of a woman who is mostly just mentioned as Putri Ceylong, which is the Ceylon princess. And this is a woman who also left a few traces in the archive. I mean, looking at different babads and after noticing her once or twice, I was then able to find her in a few places. But again, these are just hints of her life. But this is a woman who was the granddaughter of Amankurat III, the first Javanese king who was exiled to Ceylon in 1708. She was a granddaughter, and she was born in Ceylon, and then she was sent back to Java, because this is a king whose body was sent back for burial in Java, and along with around 200 of his descendants and retinue and surviving relatives. So she was, as a young girl, she was sent back to Java. It wasn't really back for her because she was, it was a new place for her. And then later on, she was sent back to Ceylon with a husband, and the husband passed away, and she went back to Java. And finally, she was banished once again, along with a brother. So I tried to think about her story as a woman, first as a girl, as a young woman, and then as an older woman, who all of her banishments and returns were determined by her relationships to different men in throughout her life.
Thank you so much for that. And you provide such a rich, vivid sketch of the life worlds of these Malays in Ceylon, from their everyday life and quotidian matters to the food they eat, to their emotional lives. So let's talk a bit more about the lives of the Ceylon Malays. Perhaps could you elaborate a little bit on the link between Malay military affiliation and the Malay's literary culture across different modes of writing? What is the role of Kandy and other cities in Ceylon in cultivating this relationship? And perhaps most importantly, how did people from such diverse locales like Batavia, Penang, Patani, Bugis, Banten, Aceh come to see themselves as Malay?
Yes, so I think, you know, we often, at least today, we don't really connect soldiers or military life with high literature or literary production. But in the case of the Malays in colonial Ceylon, and now I'm talking mostly about the 19th century, where Ceylon was under British rule. So we really have, I mean, it's in the book, it's clear, but I didn't really talk about it here, that we're looking across two colonial regimes, first until 1795, the Dutch, and of course before that also the Portuguese, but my research did not go that far back. But in terms of the story of exile and banishment and military service, we're talking about the Dutch period until 1795, and then the British period. And so in the 19th century, the early 19th century, the British recruited Malays to their military even earlier, because we have British reports after the conquest of Ceylon from the Dutch, where they were very impressed with the Malay soldiers, the Malays as fighters fighting for on the side of the Dutch, and therefore they decided that they would also recruit them to their own military. And in the early 19th century, they established the Malay Regiment, and that regiment plays a very important part in Malay life in Ceylon until it's disbanded in 1873. So for several decades, many of the Malay men and boys enlist in this regiment, and the military is not only an important part of individual lives, but also of the community. And so what we find is that many of the manuscripts, if you look at the notes on the manuscripts or openings and endings, many of the manuscripts were owned by members of the Malay regiment or retirees of the regiment. A lot of the reading of these manuscripts and the copying was done in the barracks or in cantonments that were, the living quarters of families close to the military barracks. We have reports of or notes in the manuscripts about manuscripts being brought back from Southeast Asia. That is when these Malay soldiers were on tour, especially in Singapore and sometimes also Malay Peninsula. Places like Penang or Malacca, they would make a point of either copying manuscripts or purchasing manuscripts and bringing them back. And we also have, we also know that there were schools or classes for the Malay children in these military settlements where they were taught the Jawi script, and they were taught to the knowledge of reading the script and reading these manuscripts and literature was passed on to the next generation. So we have a very strong connection between this aspect of Malay life, military life, and these military communities, and the development and the maintenance, the preservation of these writing traditions. Candy has a sort of a long history and a very prominent place in the history of Ceylon and also of in colonial Ceylon. My main point in bringing Candy in was that we have this story of, again, in the relationship in relation to the military of Malays, and there are many reports on this in the archive, especially in the British archive, of Malays serving on both sides, of serving the in the British military, like was just mentioned now, and also serving on the side of the King of Kandy. And these were two sides at war in the early 19th century. There was a series of the First Candian War, the Second Candian War, etc. And the Malays, as a community, lived with this these divided loyalties. On the one hand, they were a single community, but in terms of their affiliation, their military affiliation, they often found themselves on two sides of the coin, and it tells us something about their position within Ceylon society. On the one hand, it was a position of privilege because they were desired as warriors, as fighters on both sides. But it's also in some ways a very precarious position as outsiders. That is, the King of Kandy, for example, always trusted them as his guards and soldiers because they were seen as foreigners. And the highlight of this story about Candy and the Malays is a story that I tell in one of the chapters about two brothers, the Nuruddin brothers, one of whom fought on the side of the British and the other on the side of the King of Candy. And I use that story and the sort of sources that talk about it from different perspectives to highlight this this position of the Malays within the larger colonial society. And I also found it very interesting that at least one of the traditions talks about these Nuruddin brothers being buried, or one of them at least being buried within the compound of the very, very important Buddhist temple in Kandy, which is the temple of the tooth, where one of the Buddha's teeth is supposed to be preserved, that in fact it's the power of the Muslim saints, of the Malay saints, that saved this temple from Tamil tigers' attack during the height of the conflict in Sri Lanka. So we find here also these echoes of this Malay past and Malay bravery and Malay courage and Malay religious Muslim potency in the places where we would expect to find it, but also which is within the Malay communities, traditions, but also in very unexpected places. What was the other thing you asked me?
How did people from these diverse locales come to see themselves as Malay?
Right. So that's like a million-dollar question, I think, because I try in my book to offer explanations. I mean, I hope that at least in some ways the story that I tell relates to this question. And of course, there is the passage of time. There is the dominance of the Malay language that in some ways we can explain this by thinking about the Malay as a lingua franca across Southeast Asia and especially Muslim Southeast Asia long before this episode of banishment. So the idea that people came from all over the archipelago and spoke different languages, but they also might have known, or at least some of them, probably knew Malay, and this could have been a connecting link for them, a way to communicate across this linguistic diversity. I mean, we have those kinds of explanations. We also know that at least some of the people spent time in Batavia, which is now Jakarta, before being exiled or before being sent away as soldiers or as slaves, because the community was made up not just of these royal exiles, but of convicts and slaves and soldiers. In Batavia, there was a form of Malay was spoken. But still, I think that this question is still an open question. I think we still don't know enough about this process. And again, for me, because I was looking mostly at written materials, at written texts, at manuscripts, I think it's quite striking that we have so few traces of other Indonesian languages in these manuscripts. It may be because, you know, because what we have is relatively late, is mostly from the early 19th century onwards. Perhaps if we had sources from the late 17th century or early 18th century, we would find, you know, Javanese and Madurese and Balinese and Bugis. Maybe we would have a whole range of languages. But based on the sources that we have today, what we find that Malay became very clearly the most dominant language and dominant idiom for this community.
Thank you so much for that. And before we move to our last traditional question, can you perhaps read a paragraph from the book for our listeners?
Yes, sure. Okay, so this is from the very final page of the book. For Sri Lanka's history, thinking in terms of Sarandib provides a way to connect the island to other places and to Muslims across space and time because of the religious and historical importance of this designation and its appearance in multiple stories and textual traditions. Sarandib is a land reminiscent of paradise in its riches and beauty, a gateway, an entry point to the world as Adam first saw it. And later, with this history as background, an island favored by Muslim traders traversing the Indian Ocean, as well as many a pilgrim ship from Southeast Asia making its way to Arabia. Thus, invoking the name Sarandib offers inroads to considering the experiences and worldviews of the minority community of Malays who are often marginalized in official histories and grand narratives of the island. And it also suggests going beyond the boundaries of colonial and national histories to assess Sri Lanka's place in competing and overlapping narratives of the past in the region and further afield. In this vein, a more nuanced history of Sri Lanka would contribute also to complicating Indonesian and Indian Ocean histories and historiographies. Names, Sarandib, Lanka, Ceylon, bearing long histories and laden with particular sensibilities and associations, afforded a point of departure. Related to names are additional words and their etymologies. The name Ceylon transformed into a Malay and Javanese verb connoting banishment, while Sarandib inspired serendipity, associated with searching, finding the new and unexpected. These two words, deriving from the island's names and speaking respectively to displacement and discovery, exile and fortuitous encounters, encompass the Malay's history and the way it was remembered, retold, and imagined.
Beautiful. Well, Runeet, we've taken up a lot of your time. So just to close off this interview, could you tell us what are you working on now? And a little bit about your current and future projects or what you hope to work on.
Yes, sure. I have two projects at the moment, both of which I'm sort of relatively in the early stages of. One actually sort of grew out of a section. I don't remember which chapter it's in, but there's I think the one about the compendium. There is a section about interlinear translation, which is basically a form of translation that was very common across the Indonesian Malay world, also in other parts of the world. But I am looking at, especially at the Indonesian Malay forms of this translation. And in most of these texts, what you have is an Arabic text and then large spaces between the lines. And underneath each Arabic word, and sometimes it's even just a prefix or a suffix, you have a translation into Malay or into Javanese. And so there is an example of that, a one-page example in the book. And what I find very interesting about these translations is that they offer us a translation paradigm that in some ways is very, it seems at least, very limited. It seems very narrow. It's a word-for-word, often very literal translation. And sometimes it's so literal that if you read the Malay sentence, it doesn't really make sense because it follows the Arabic so closely. But at the same time, I feel like it opens up an entire world of thinking about, thinking again from the very small details and then widening it into a big picture, thinking about language change, thinking about transmission of cultural and religious knowledge, again, in its most minute details, beginning with its most minute details, thinking about the intellectual transmission of ideas, and also about the script. Sometimes the two languages are written in the same script, sometimes in different scripts, and there are many, many variations to this. And all of this sort of information and all of this knowledge is, we could say, hidden in between the lines. So that's one project. And the other project is about the Layang Ambio, which is the Javanese textual tradition that covers the biographies of the prophets of Islam. So that allows me to stay in touch with my friend Nabi Adam, because he's always the first in these collections. And so it tells the stories going from Adam and all the way to the Prophet Muhammad, covering the lives and the deeds of the different prophets in the Islamic tradition as they were retold in Java.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Banishment and Belonging, Exile and Diaspora in Serendip, Lanka and Ceylon, published by Cambridge University Press, 2019. This is your host, Kelvin Ng.
And I'm Ahmed Al-Mazmi.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.